Jim said I'm an honorary industrial hygienist, but I'm actually, I'm working with the senior industrial hygienist.
Somehow or other, I was just reading the note.
And I put my slide in the wrong place. So,
So
I'm working with Jim Boiano on this project. We've been working together for about 5 or 6 years on the survey, and also Marie Sweeney. So a little about surgical smoke. It's known to cause acute health effects, eye, nose, and throat irritation, headaches, nasal congestion, nausea, dizziness, coughing, asthma-like symptoms, and there are some also animal studies that link it to inflammatory changes, including emphysema, asthma, and chronic bronchitis. There have been health and safety guidelines for dealing with surgical smoke for around 20 years, so this is not a new concern. These guidelines were developed by professional practice organizations as well as government agencies. There's no OSHA standard, but they do have a e-tool site that talks about surgical smoke. These guidelines specify evidence-based practices and exposure controls where surgical smoke is generated, and these guidelines have served as the basis for the questions that we ask in the survey that I'm going to talk about. So this presentation draws from information collected by the NIOSH Health and Safety Practices Survey of Healthcare Workers, and if you're connected to NIOSH, you might have heard some of the other about some of the other modules that we've gone through. The purpose was to describe the extent of use of exposure controls and barriers by healthcare workers who handle or come in contact with hazardous chemicals. So the survey was a voluntary, anonymous, web-based survey of healthcare workers that was conducted in 2011. And the healthcare workers were invited to participate by their professional practice organization who collaborated with NIOSH. And these workers, the organizations represented workers that were likely to come in contact with the agents that we were concerned with. And these organizations sent out an email invitation with a web link so that the participants could link to the survey and do the survey. So there was a screening module that had the different questions about the different chemicals. And one of the questions was that eligible respondents responded yes to the question, at any time in the past 7 calendar days, did you work within 5 feet of the source of surgical smoke? And then it went on to ask when they were completing at least one and maybe two modules, but the surgical smoke module also asked them if they were exposed to surgical smoke during a laser surgery procedure or an electrosurgery procedure. And these were addressed in separate sub-modules due to the differences in previously reported practices and in the guidelines. And each of the sub-modules included the same questions, and respondents could answer questions in one or both of the submodules. So we had 4,533 total respondents for the module, and 4,500 responded they were exposed to surgical smoke during electrosurgery, and about 1,400 during laser surgery. And only 33 respondents responded that they were only exposed during laser surgery. 33 of the 1,392 were not exposed during electrosurgery. So we had majority women in the survey. They were also white, around 41 to 55 years of age. They were predominantly nurses, and there was a large proportion of nurse anesthetists. We had anesthesiologists, surgical technologists, and some other professions that answered the survey. Their employers were mostly hospitals, and also a third of them had over 1,000 employees employed at that location. So the data looked pretty similar for laser surgery and elective surgery in terms of how many years people reported they had worked in worked while exposed to surgical smoke. And then it gets different when you ask them how many days per week they're working in the past 7 days, how many days they're working. Those in laser surgery were predominantly only doing this procedure 1 day a week, while those in electrosurgery were doing it much more frequently, were around surgical smoke much more frequently. And then the hours they were working around surgical smoke in the past 7 days shows the same pattern, more hours for those in electrosurgery. And the same pattern with the number of surgical procedures that they were involved in. So we also asked them what kind of training they received on the hazards of surgical smoke. And this question was actually just asked one time, but I split them up into those who did surgical and those who did electrosurgery. So they look pretty similar in terms of training. Only a fourth of them have been trained in the last 12 months, and then fewer greater than 12 months ago, and a large proportion had never been trained on the hazards of surgical smoke. And then this question also was only asked once. About a third of them reported that their employer has standard procedures that address the potential hazards of surgical smoke. A third didn't, and then a third just didn't know whether or not they did. One of the main recommendations for working around surgical smoke is that the procedure be evacuated using local exhaust ventilation. So for laser surgery, about half of them said that local exhaust ventilation is always used. But for electrosurgery, it's much, much less, only 14%. And then more than 50% was never used during their electrosurgery procedures they were part of. So some of the reasons they reported for not using local exhaust ventilation were that it wasn't part of their protocol to use them. And some said the exposure was not great enough to use it. And then also it's not provided by their employer. About a fourth of them said that. And they could mark more than one choice on this question. We asked them about use of respirators, and this obviously wasn't the reason they weren't using LAV, because nobody was really using respirators. As you can expect, most of them reported that they used standard surgical masks, and for laser surgery, they said they used laser masks during the surgeries. And then the reasons they reported for not using respirators, about half of them said it's not part of their protocol. They didn't have, their exposure was low, and they weren't provided. And so in discussion, local exhaust ventilation is not widely used. This is especially true for electrosurgery procedures, where workers report more days, more hours, and more procedures exposed to surgical smoke. Our results indicate that workplaces do not prioritize control of surgical smoke. There's a lack of training, lack of facility procedures for preventing exposure to surgical smoke, and they say that it's not part of their protocol, their exposure was minimal, and it's not provided. These results echo work by Ball, who found education and training, as well as leadership support, influence compliance with recommendations, which we agree with. So this wasn't a representative sample of healthcare workers who are exposed to surgical smoke by any means. It was dominated by anesthesia professionals. The information wasn't collected on the type of surgical procedure which was performed, which would dictate how much smoke might be produced. and no information was collected if they reported that they used some other system instead of local exhaust ventilation. Although we did, if they didn't mark any of the reasons given, we did give them a chance to write in something, and some of them said blood suction canisters, so the devices used to clear the surgical field of blood and other liquids that might have been used, but that would probably clog up the filters that were being used for the surgical smoke. So the respondent was not the primary person in charge of ensuring that local exhaust ventilation was used. It was just other people that were in the area being exposed. So our conclusions: point source control of surgical smoke has been recommended for many years, but despite this, use of LEV is lacking. Employers need to ensure that workers are aware of the hazards. National guidelines are in place, and support for their implementation is understood by the hospital as well as by the people involved in the surgery. And LEV is available, and workers are trained on its use and in working order. And workers can seek out training, understand and follow facility procedures, and then ask questions and report safety concerns to their employers. So here are some of the other publications that came out of our survey if you're interested. And here is my other disclaimer and my contact information.
Someone else who is very good with time. Thank you. A question or two right now? Or?
This is actually a burning question. Yes. How did you define electrosurgery?
I can send you the questionnaire. We asked them, it was electrosurgery, electrocautery, and diathermy.
So did that then include, I guess the question really is electrosurgery only specific procedures for electrosurgery is used for like ablation of some sort of lesion, or was it when electrosurgical cauterization was used during other types of surgical procedures?
Could other people hear this?
No.
Could you explain what the question was?
So he was asking if it was used during other procedures, or if it was... Yeah, please.
So I was just curious about whether electrosurgery was defined as only specific procedures that were electrosurgical in nature, or whether it was if electrosurgical tools were used for, like, cauterization during other, you know, traditional types of surgical procedures.
So the answer is yes. We didn't limit it to one thing. So if they said they were exposed to surgical smoke, they were eligible to complete the module.
Okay. I have a question. What's in surgical smoke?
There's a lot of things that they've identified, 150 different compounds, including formaldehyde comes to mind. But it could be viruses and bacterial and particulate matter, too.
Actually, in your abstract, you have a fair starting list, although it's more. PAH is benzene, cyanide, formaldehyde, cellular material, viruses, and bacteria.
Thank
That's
you.
A good starter.
Thank you.
It works.
So one of the things they did say when they said they used the respirators, there's a story of a surgeon, I think, being exposed to HPV through surgical smoke and being infected. And so all of the nurses were aware of that story, and also they were worried about, they said they wore the N95s when they were aware the patient had tuberculosis. So that was the 4%.
Do you have any measuring to quantify the level of the particulate matter?
No, we didn't, but Bradley King, who's here, he just finished his dissertation on surgical smoke, and he'll be coming out, I'm sure, with some papers. That I started with one of his HATs, was one of my starting points for looking at.
The other thing I'd be curious about is who's enforcing the rules around this. It's great to have guidelines, but if nobody's enforcing it, it's great for workers to complain, but who's going to come out and enforce these rules and issue citations?
I don't think it's not going to be OSHA.
Chris is going to be there.
Does the ANSI standard on lasers address it at all?
So it is mentioned that, so they call them laser-borne, airborne contaminants, and so laser kind of implies just laser, but they do have a paragraph in the back of the standard saying that surgical smoke and from other procedures should be evacuated. So they mention it, but I think that's one of the reasons that there's more laser surgery. The AORN has a great ad campaign about smoking in the OR and a nurse standing there over the patient smoking. It's very interesting.
Great, thank you very much.